of legal counsel, some large hospital systems have moved away from a policy of admit nothing that could later be used against us in court to a policy of openness and honesty with patients when mistakes are made. This new shift makes no sense. If patients, the hospital's customers, are primarily seeking monetary value. By admitting a mistake to someone who can sue you for malpractice, you are essentially handing over your checkbook and asking him if he would also like to borrow your pen. But with an understanding that not all exchanges are driven by cold, hard monetary calculations, these hospitals hypothesized that some malpractice suits are actually motivated by a desire for psychological value. People in hospitals are in a uniquely vulnerable position. They are putting their lives quite literally into the hands of others. Now, if something goes wrong and the hospital's defenses go up, as if these vulnerable patients were greedy, raiding barbarians, well, people understandably react quite badly to that. They hire a lawyer and they sue. But when some hospitals adopted this new system of seeking to provide non-monetary psychological value to patients by admitting mistakes, sincerely apologizing, and keeping patients fully informed, an amazing thing happened. Malpractice lawsuits actually went down. The University of Michigan Health System was one of the first major hospital systems to implement a full disclosure policy in cases where healthcare providers made a mistake. In 2001, before the policy change, there were 262 lawsuits against the health system. By 2007, after it became common for doctors to apologize and admit fault, the number of lawsuits dropped to less than a third of that previous number, just 83. The dollar amount of settled lawsuits also went down. Understanding your customer's source of value allows you to position your offering in a way that provides them with a reason for choosing your product. Some product attributes are just naturally consonant with certain sources of value. For example, if you're the low-priced leader in a market, then that makes it especially likely that you'll be able to appeal to customers who are seeking monetary value. But many product attributes are translatable, fungible, if you like. They can be communicated in ways that emphasize each of these sources of value. For example, suppose you make a truck and it has a more powerful engine than the competition. That would seem to be a functional attribute, right? After all, engine power concerns how well a truck performs its functional purpose of moving things around. So, engine power is functional. Well, maybe. For customers who need to carry heavy loads or tow things around, then a powerful engine would in fact be a source of functional value. But there's another group of customers who would be interested in a powerful engine for psychological reasons. They will never haul a single thing. That might scratch the paint. But a big beefy truck makes them feel powerful or cool or whatever. You know these guys. They're the ones who consider a Ford F-150 to be just a girly version of the F-350. There could even be a group of customers who could derive social value from having a truck with a powerful engine. You might earn the respect of a certain group of people by having the most powerful truck in its class. Maybe you'll be ostracized on the job site unless you have a big manly truck. For this group of customers, engine power provides social value. And that social value provides customers with a reason to choose. So, for a given product attribute, there's often a positioning decision to be made. How do I, as a marketer, communicate the advantages of that attribute to the customer? And to answer that question, you should know which of these sources of values is most likely to drive choice for your target customer. Is it social value? Well, then communications emphasizing psychological benefits or monetary benefits might fall flat. The key is to translate the source of value offered into the language of the type of value your customers are seeking. Don't rely on your customers to do that work for themselves. All right. Now we've got a place to start in figuring out what customers value. We'll talk much more about this as the course proceeds. But first, let's take a step back and remember our definition of marketing. Marketing creates value for customers and the company. And we can figure out how to do this by answering three simple questions. First, who are my customers? Second, what do they value? And third, how can I give them what they value better than the competition? If you can answer those three questions, then you have the basis for a marketing strategy. And it's only after you have a strategy that you can begin to figure out the best tactics to employ. I've organized the course to emphasize this natural split between strategic questions, those that must be answered first, and tactical questions, which must be answered in order to successfully implement your strategy. So the first half of the course, we'll learn how to develop a marketing strategy by learning how to answer those three fundamental questions. Who are my customers? What do they value? And how can I give them what they value better than the competition? Then, in the second half of the course, we'll investigate marketing tactics, addressing such issues as branding, pricing, and communication. And by the time you finish the course, you'll be able to solve complex marketing problems like, how can I develop a healthy food that McDonald's customers will actually eat? So, what did McDonald's do to solve this problem? Well, they followed the rules of marketing that I just laid out for you. The first thing they did was recognize that they were not serving just one monolithic group of McDonald's customers, but instead they were serving many different types of people, different segments of consumers. And they realized if they wanted their healthy food item to be successful, they had to create something that a particular segment of customers would want, not just a generic healthy option. So, which segment did they choose? Well, they did some research, and they discovered that a surprisingly large number of orders were for one or two Happy Meals and a Diet Coke. Turned out there were a lot of parents, primarily mothers, who were willing to take their kids to McDonald's, but who were not interested in buying a heavy, greasy burger for themselves. So, McDonald's developed a new line of premium salads, specifically designed to appeal to those parents. It's important to note that these were not primarily destination salads. This wouldn't be a salad for salad connoisseurs who really wanted a fantastic and healthy salad and were willing to drive across town to get it. That would be a really hard battle for McDonald's to win. No, the salad they created was specifically designed to serve a customer who was already in the restaurant under duress. McDonald's didn't need to convince people to come to their restaurants for a salad. All they needed to do was provide an offering that was just a little bit better than having no food at all. And they did. After introducing their premium salads, the average Happy Meal order went up from about $5 a ticket to about $9. The magic was not in introducing a new salad. McDonald's had introduced healthy options in the past, and they had failed. In general, people don't come to McDonald's looking for healthy food, so trying to lure them in with a healthy offering will generally not work. That's important, because a salad intended to draw people into the store might have looked very different from the one they developed. But McDonald's identified a segment that was already in the store and specifically designed an offering to meet that customer's needs. Know who your customer is and what they value. That's the first rule of marketing. We'll talk more about that next time.
This lecture is titled, How to Segment a Market.
In the late 1990s and early 2000s, Microsoft was trying to make headway into the market for server software. It already dominated the market for desktop operating systems with Windows, but many businesses were using Unix and Linux software to run their servers, so this market represented a real opportunity for Microsoft. Now, imagine you were a Microsoft salesperson going out into the field, contacting the IT groups at various small and medium-sized businesses to try to convince them to buy more Microsoft software, or even better, to switch from their current software to Microsoft's offering. What would you say? How would you convince them? What's the most compelling reason you could give an IT manager to get them to consider Microsoft's product? Careful, that's a trick question. Don't answer it. The answer is, it depends. Different IT managers will have different needs, and so will respond positively to different sales pitches. Instead of developing a single sales approach tailored at the average IT manager, Microsoft did some research, and they discovered that there were five main types of IT manager. For example, they discovered that approximately 24% of this market was a group they called Linux experimenters. These were IT managers who worked for companies that mostly used Microsoft, but they were experimenting with using Linux in some small initiatives with an eye towards possibly expanding use later. Another group was made up of market followers. They were potentially interested in using the newer, less established Linux, but they were waiting to see how the broader industry responded before making any sudden moves themselves. This group was about 9% of the market. Another group, comprising about 18%, were Linux aficionados. These were people who were aggressively deploying Linux technologies because they believed Linux was a superior product. Armed with this knowledge, Microsoft developed specific sales approaches for each type of IT manager. They knew, for example, that Linux experimenters would respond better to certain types of deals and persuasive appeals than would market followers. They also knew that when a salesperson came across a Linux aficionado in the field, this person was likely to be a lost cause for Microsoft. The salesperson could probably spend his or her time more effectively somewhere else. This recognition that people are not all the same, but want different things, is the foundation of segmentation, which is the topic of today's lecture. We have already seen that the first question in developing a marketing strategy is, who is my customer? Well, segmentation is how you begin to answer that question. If time and budget allow, the best way to segment a market is always to invest in some good marketing research. But even when you have the time and money to conduct good research, market data alone will not be enough to create a good segmentation. Grouping people together in useful ways requires some creativity and some insight. Today we're going to talk through the basic principles that underlie a good segmentation analysis, whether it's conducted with the best data available or conducted with less than perfect market data, as often happens when firms are under tight timelines or budget constraints. The first thing to understand is that there is no single right way to segment a market. Different brands can successfully segment exactly the same market in radically different ways. The second thing to understand is that segmentation is not a one-time prospect. Markets are fluid. New customers come in, existing customers move out. Competitors come and go and gain and lose market share. It's not enough to segment a market once and never return to it again. Resegmenting a market is something you should do periodically. Segmentation is a great way to identify new opportunities or to fix existing problems. When you conduct your segmentation analysis, your segments should be both mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive. In other words, everyone in the market should be in a segment, and each segment should be distinct, and to the extent possible, not overlap with other segments. Now, here's where most people make their first mistake. The segments that you form should be based on what people value and not based on differences and demographic characteristics. Not based on age or gender or geography, but based on what people want and need. You will eventually create demographic profiles of your segments, but it's usually not helpful to start with demographics. This idea of segmenting by value and not by demographics is counterintuitive. It's one of the insights that my MBA students have the most trouble grappling with. When you ask someone to divide potential customers into groups, it's only natural to start by putting men and women into different groups, or putting different age groups separately, or income groups separately. This is just the way most people think. If you ask someone to describe their customer, it's very likely they will say something like, "Our target customer is young men aged 16 to 22 from upper middle class households living in suburban neighborhoods with moderate levels of disposable income." And that sounds like a very specific target, doesn't it? But is it really? Just think of the diversity of identities, motivations, desires, and values, all contained within that one fairly specific demographic segment. Think back to when you were that age. Or if that was too long ago, just go out and rent a John Hughes movie from the 1980s. The high schools depicted in Pretty in Pink and Ferris Bueller's Day Off and The Breakfast Club, they were all filled with young men who fit exactly that demographic description. But this was not a monolithic group. There were cool kids and outsiders, conformists and burnouts, punk rockers and suburban cowboys. Did all of those young men, all aged 16 to 22, all from upper middle class households, all living in suburban neighborhoods, did they all really want the same things? Did they buy the same brands? Did they try to project the same image to the world? Segmenting people by demographic descriptors alone will not tell you anything about the underlying values that drive their decision making. If you create segments based on surface differences only, you won't know what to do with the segments when you're done. So, what's the alternative? Well, in contrast to demographic profiling, using things like age and gender and race and ethnicity, income and zip code, savvy marketers try to create psychographic segments, grouping people together based on what they value, similarities in their psychological needs and desires, and in the images they want to project to the world. These are the similarities that really matter. Let me give you an example to illustrate what I mean when I say you should always segment by psychographics and not demographics. I had an MBA student who was hired by a major cable television company. This company was facing a problem. Some of its customers were unsubscribing from the cable company. They were either switching to another provider or just cutting the cord entirely. To address this problem, the company decided to do a segmentation analysis. They wanted to identify those customers who are most likely to defect so they could know where to focus their efforts to limit customer defections. So far, so good. Now, cable companies have an amazing amount of information about their customers. They have specific names and addresses, which already puts them well ahead of the vast majority of marketers. They also know how long someone has been their customer, whether that household subscribes to premium packages, how many movies they've ordered through pay-per-view, whether they bundle with cable TV and phone and internet. The list goes on. Most companies would love to have this kind of detailed information about their customers. And for the cable company, it's all just there, sitting in a database, waiting to be used. So they used it. They took that information about both their customers and those customers who had recently canceled the service, and they grouped people together based on the information they had, where they lived, which packages they subscribed to, estimated income. And after creating several distinct customer groups, they found that there was one segment that was both particularly profitable and particularly likely to leave. Great. Now they know where to focus their marketing efforts. And this was where my student came into the picture. His first job at this new company was to take that information about that segment and determine a plan for reducing defection rates. Now, imagine you've been given this task. What would you do? How would you convince this specific segment of customers to stick with cable? You have lots of options to choose from. You could just lower the price for just these customers. Or you could offer them some discount on specific services, maybe cheaper sports package or better deals on bundling. Or you could work to upgrade the service in their area, make it more reliable. Or you could give them access to new technology first, before it goes to anyone else. The possibilities are almost endless. Now, out of all the possible ways you have for trying to convince these customers to stay, which one do you choose? How do you know which will convince them to stay? What would you do? Don't bother to answer that. It's another trick question. The correct answer is you can't know, because this segment of customers was created by looking at similarities in demographics and behavior, by their income and zip code, and how long they had been a customer. But none of these things tell you very much about what these people actually value. We know that this group is in danger of defecting, but the segmentation analysis we used doesn't tell us anything about why they're leaving. Suppose that instead of segmenting by outward similarities, you had begun by investigating the different reasons people have for subscribing to cable in the first place. Suppose you went out and surveyed your current and former customers and created a value-based psychographic segmentation. If you had done this, you might have discovered a group you might call price sensitives, those who are primarily motivated by finding the lowest price for basic cable service. You might have found another group. We'll call them sports junkies. They seek out the best and most inclusive sports packages available. This group isn't that sensitive to price, so long as they can watch the games they care about. Another group might be motivated by bandwidth. These data hogs want as much speed as they can get for the dollar. Others might be technology lovers who want the latest and greatest products available. This kind of segmentation is harder to do than a demographic segmentation, not least because it requires additional information than what was already available in the company's database. Often, this kind of segmentation requires additional marketing research. But once you have a value-based psychographic segmentation, it's infinitely more useful. For example, what if, after conducting this kind of psychographic segmentation, the company discovered that technology lovers were both especially profitable and especially likely to cancel their service? Well, now they have some insight into what types of marketing actions might actually be effective in retaining those customers. In that case, if they want to retain these customers and attract more like them, the cable company has a clear path forward. They need to invest in new technology, to be the first out there with new innovations, and to trumpet technology in their advertising. Offering price discounts to this group probably wouldn't halt the defections, because they weren't leaving to seek a better price. It's even possible that lowering prices could make things worse. If this group of tech-savvy customers thinks that the price discounts mean the cable company is some kind of cheap bargain basement provider, it could actually cause them to leave faster. As I said before, there's no single right way to segment a market, but there are wrong ways. And demographic segmentation is the wrong way to do it. Make sure that your segmentation analysis will lead to value-based segments, segments you can actually use. With this crucial principle in mind, let's now address a very practical question. How does one actually conduct a segmentation analysis? Let me give you three approaches: user-based, benefit-based, and occasion-based. Each of these three segmentation approaches should lead to the same outcome: a mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive set of customer segments grouped together based on similarities in their underlying values. These segmentation approaches are the first elements of what I will refer to as the marketing toolbox. The toolbox contains a set of tools that you can use to apply the theories we discuss to the specific problems you face. These tools will come in many forms. Some will be frameworks. Others will be checklists or exercises. But when you hear me mention the marketing toolbox, you'll know I'm about to talk about application. So let's open our toolbox. One way to segment a market is to conduct a user-based segmentation analysis. This approach involves starting with a list of all the different types or classes of people who might use your product or service. Let's walk through this process using satellite phones as an example. Let's brainstorm. Who are the different types of people who might use a satellite phone? What jobs might they do? Well, here's a list of potential candidates. Military personnel, international journalists, NGOs, some people who work in international business, maybe first responders. I'm sure you could come up with others. Again, to do this right, you really should go out and conduct market research to identify these groups. But when you don't have the time or money to conduct good research, a quick and easy brainstorming effort can often yield surprising insights. So, now that we have our list of potential user groups, the next step is to figure out what would be important for each of those groups. So let's go through my list. What attributes and benefits of a satellite phone would be important to the military? They might want something that's especially rugged. It can be easily repaired in the field. Easy to use would certainly be appreciated, but it's probably not essential since the military is very good at training people to use complicated equipment. And price, if you've followed military procurement stories over the past few decades, well, price is probably not all that important. What about international business travelers? How would their list of important attributes and benefits be different? They would probably want something relatively small and inconspicuous. A soldier might not mind using a big brick of a phone with a long antenna so long as it works when he needs it to. A business executive, on the other hand, probably cares much more about the phone's design and whether it can fit in a pocket or a purse. Business travelers will also place a premium on ease of use. These are busy people who don't have time or patience to devote to learning about a new complicated gadget. We could go on, but that gives you the general idea. For each group, think about what would be important and what would not matter so much. The end result should be a list of customer segments with a rich description of their preference structures. The more detailed and specific you can get in describing what each group would want, the better off you'll be when it comes time to pick a target and to position your offering. We'll talk more about those topics in subsequent lectures. Once you've created your detailed list of segments, the next step is to see if any of the groups overlap in terms of what they value. If two groups end up wanting almost exactly the same things in the offering, they're probably the same segment, not two. Each segment should have a distinct value profile. In other words, each segment should want clearly different things. If they don't, combine them. For example, we might find that NGOs and international journalists want nearly identical things. If that's the case, they should be combined into a single segment. Remember, our goal is to get psychographically distinct groups. It's okay if one psychographic segment includes multiple types of users, just so long as they all want the same things. Another thing that could happen at this stage is you could find the initial user groups you defined should actually be broken up into subsegments. For example, after some research, you might discover that some NGOs operate primarily in established areas, but make periodic excursions into more remote, less developed areas, whereas others headquarter and operate exclusively in remote areas. You might further determine that these two types of NGOs would value different things in the satellite phone. In that case, you would divide what started as one segment into two. So, that's user-based segmentation. You start by determining the different types of users who might use your offering And then you derive your value-based segments from that list of users. The second approach to segmentation is a benefits-based analysis. For this type of segmentation, you start with the offering itself, instead of starting with the consumer. Think of all the different types of benefits a consumer might derive from using this product or service, and then determine your segments accordingly. Ask yourself, what benefits are most likely to drive purchase in this category? Let's use a different product category to illustrate how a benefits-based segmentation works. So let's brainstorm. What are the benefits associated with cold cereals? Here are a few things that come to mind. First, many cereals are sweet. They're delicious. That's a benefit. Cold cereal is also a cheap meal. It's fast and easy to prepare. Many contain health benefits, whole grains, fiber, vitamins, nutrients. Most are bite-sized and easy to handle. Now we have our list of benefits, and we can back our way into user segments by determining which groups of people are most likely to appreciate each particular benefit. Work out descriptions of the groups who would value each benefit. For example, who would care about the purported heart benefits associated with whole grains? Careful, it's not just those who have a real need to lower their cholesterol as diagnosed by a doctor, though that's likely to be a sizable group. It would actually be anyone who thinks they need to manage their cholesterol, which is likely a larger group. As you go through the list of benefits, look for opportunities to refine your segments. Can you split any of the benefits-based segments you've created? Should you combine any? For example, people who would appreciate having a quick and easy meal include families with small children. But it might also include singles living alone who don't want to go through the hassle of preparing an entire meal just for one person. These two groups might both appreciate the primary benefit of ease of preparation, but they might differ on some other attributes, such as price sensitivity or health consciousness. As with the user-based segmentation, the end result of the benefits-based segmentation should be a list of consumer segments with a rich description of their preference structures. The more detailed and specific, the better. The third segmentation approach differs from the other two in that it doesn't start with the premise that each person or household should be assigned to a different segment. Instead, it recognizes that the same person may have different needs depending on the occasion in which he or she uses the offering. Thus, an occasion-based segmentation starts by asking, when would consumers buy or use this product or service? Let's use wine for our example in this case. What are the different occasions for which a person might buy or consume wine? Well, you might buy wine to accompany a meal, or as part of a social activity, like a dinner or an office party, or as a gift, or just to unwind at the end of a day. You might even consider the use of wine in some religious ceremonies. Unlike a user-based segmentation, any particular customer can fit into any or all of those occasion-based segments. After all, the same person might pick a very different bottle of wine to give as a gift than they would to serve at a dinner party. Starting with this list of occasions, we then consider the things people would want in each of those different situations. For example, what are the properties of a wine that would be valued when having dinner at home with the family? Depending on the family, potency might actually be very valued in that case. Would people seek something different for wine consumed at a restaurant, or wine selected as a gift? The difference between all these three different types of segmentation approaches, user-based, benefits-based, and occasion-based, is in providing you with different places to start the process, to provide you with different angles for looking at the same market. But importantly, all of these approaches should lead to the same end result, a list of customer segments that differ in their preference structures. None of these segmentation approaches is right for a given market. In fact, I would encourage you to try multiple approaches to see if each new perspective provides any additional insights. Regardless of the method you have used to generate your psychographic or value-based segments, once you've defined your segments, you're not done. Value-based segments are useful because they tell you the types of marketing actions that will appeal to that group of people. Think back to our example of the cable TV provider. Technology lovers is a much easier group to know what to do with than middle-class white men aged 45 to 55. For this reason, your goal should always be to derive value-based segments. However, although value-based segments provide the advantage of being relevant for consumers' decision-making, they suffer the distinct disadvantage of being difficult to reach through advertising or direct marketing. You likely won't be able to distinguish a technology lover from a data hog if they're both walking down the street. For this reason, it's usually necessary to layer a demographic description on top of your value-based segments. Now, after making such a big deal about the dangers of demographic segmentation, you may think I'm reversing myself here, but I'm not. The order is important. Let me give you an example. A few years ago, Walmart conducted a segmentation analysis that concluded with 7 value-based segments. They labeled these groups with descriptive names like social shoppers and convenience seekers. One group was called brand aspirationals. This group had the psychographic characteristics of being very brand conscious. For example, they indicated they were strongly influenced by what others think of them and considered themselves to be trendy and fashion forward. But they were not particularly brand loyal, suggesting they met their needs to be trendy and fashionable through a number of different brands. For each of these psychographic profiles, Walmart also created a demographic profile. For example, their research revealed that brand aspirationals were equally likely to be split between men and women. They were slightly below the national average in terms of education and income. They were, on average, young and well-mixed ethnically, but disproportionately African American and Hispanic. They also learned that this group loved sports, especially professional football. They learned what cable TV channels they watched most often, what magazines they tended to read, and how they spent their free time. And when all these different types of information are layered on top of each other, Walmart had a segmentation that was really useful to them. They knew what each of these particular groups wanted, which helped them know how to customize their stores to serve each of these segments. But they also knew, more or less, what these customers looked like, what they watched and read, so they had a better idea of where and how to advertise to them, how to communicate with them. There are many different paths to successfully segmenting a market. Market segmentation presents a real opportunity for marketers to get creative in determining the different sources of value different customer groups might seek. Just remember that whichever process you use to develop your segments, make sure that you are getting a value-based segmentation so that you end up with segments you can actually use. So, that segmentation, the first step in answering that first question in determining a marketing strategy. Who is my customer? In the next 2 lectures, we'll build on this by talking about targeting, which is the process of selecting the segment or segments you'll serve, and positioning, which is figuring out how to best serve your target customer.
This lecture is titled, Targeting a Market Segment.
In 2011, Dr. Pepper launched a new low-calorie version of its iconic soda. This version used a different kind of sweetener and boasted only 10 calories per serving, compared with more than 100 for the full-calorie version. Dr. Pepper 10 launched with an ad that looked like a parody of a blockbuster action movie trailer. The ad featured a man talking into the camera, extolling the virtues of Dr. Pepper 10. As he spoke, The man was firing a laser gun at ninjas and driving through the jungle, dodging explosions. Dr. Pepper 10 was presented as a manly soda, set apart from those other diet sodas by containing 10 manly calories. The commercial even ended with the tagline, Dr. Pepper 10, it's not for women. Now, you may be thinking, wasn't this foolish of Dr. Pepper? They're alienating half of their potential customers. Why wouldn't they claim their sodas for everyone? Let's think about this for a second. Why might someone not choose one of the dozens of zero-calorie sodas on the market already, instead of going for a Dr. Pepper 10? What advantage could this new soda claim? There are probably several reasons someone might be interested in a low-calorie drink, but not be happy with one of the current slate of offerings. But let's consider just one. Diet drinks, particularly the market leaders, Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi, tend to be thought of as drinks preferred by women. Now, some men won't care about this, just as some men will happily belly up to the bar and order an Appletini because that's what they're in the mood for and they don't care what anyone has to think about that. But some men will care. Some men want the benefits of a low-calorie soda without the stigma of being seen drinking a girl's drink. So, the folks at Dr. Pepper very cleverly added 10 calories to this new diet soda in order to provide some psychological space for men who wanted a more masculine diet soda. This is the soda equivalent of claiming that a light beer is less filling. If Dr. Pepper 10 had come out and said, this new 10-calorie soda is for everyone, then there's a good chance no one would have bought it because everyone already has a soda they're drinking. Today we're going to talk about targeting. And the good people at Dr. Pepper have just taught you your first lesson in proper targeting. Pick one target, one specific target for each offering. In our last lecture, we talked about segmentation, the process of grouping people together based on similarities and what they value. Targeting is the next step, deciding which of those segments you're going to serve and which you're not going to serve. Some companies divide people up into different groups, but then try to pursue all of those groups simultaneously with the same offering. Our product is for everyone. This is a little like carefully separating out your laundry, the whites from the colors from the delicates, and then throwing them all in the same washing machine. In order to get the most out of your segmentation, you must decide which groups are a good match for your offerings, or potential offerings, and which are not. If you segment without targeting, your marketing will fail because you will not sufficiently tailor your offering to meet the needs of any particular customer group. You'll also end up with pink underwear. The key is to recognize that by creating value for one segment, you are almost certainly making your offering less attractive to other segments. What appeals to independent thinkers will not appeal to conformists. What parents like, their teenagers may hate. What appeals to bleeding-edge trendsetters will be anathema to the masses, at least for a while. Know who your customer is, and just as important, know who your customer is not. This is a hard thing for many business people to cope with. We think of all those potential customers out there, all those people in those non-target segments, and we know that those people have money, and they're not going to be spending that money to buy our products and services, and that knowledge is painful. So we're tempted to go after everyone, to claim that this product is for everyone. This is a mistake. Unless you are a monopoly, like the power company or the DMV, your customer can't be everyone. You have to pick a target. You have to try to meet the specific needs of just that segment. If you don't, if instead you try to create something that will appeal to everyone, it will very likely be that you will end up creating something that appeals to no one. Let me illustrate this with a very simple example. Suppose you've done your value-based segmentation and you've discovered there are only two types of customers in a certain market. These two customer groups base their decisions entirely on the color of the offering. One customer segment likes blue, and another customer segment likes red. You, as the manufacturer, have to pick one color for your production run. You have a choice. You can choose to paint your offering blue and perfectly target the blue customer group. Or you can paint it red and try to appeal to the red customer group. Or you cleverly say to yourself, I can paint it purple and ask them both to meet me halfway. If you're a monopolist, this may work just fine. Neither segment gets exactly what they want, but they've got nowhere else to go. So both groups hold their noses and buy the purple option rather than go without. You get everyone. But what if you're not the only manufacturer serving this market? What if there are other manufacturers out there who are willing to provide offerings that are just red or just blue? Then your compromise solution will end up being a second best solution for all the customers on the market. Without a specific target in mind, your competition will outflank you by providing each customer segment with something much closer to what they want. You lose everyone. But you're saying to yourself, aren't there some offerings that have to appeal to more than one group of customer? For example, some products are bought by one person and consumed by another. In cases like that, don't you have to target both groups in order to be successful? This is a very good question. The answer is no. You should still have one target, even in those cases. Let me explain using another example. Let's go on an imaginary trip down the dairy aisle of your favorite grocery store. We have just come to the yogurt section, and we see that a few shelves in this refrigerator case are specifically devoted to kids' yogurts. Aha, you're saying to yourself, this is exactly the kind of product I was thinking of. The parent buys it, the kid eats it, therefore the target should be both parents and kids. Well, maybe. Let's get specific. One of the offerings in the refrigerator case is Horizon Organic brand yogurt tubes. The package is brightly colored. It features the cartoon cow from the Horizon Organics logo, only he's riding a snowboard. The copy informs us that this box contains portable organic low-fat yogurt in a tube for kids on the go. Now, based on this description, who is the target for this product? If you're like anything like my MBA students, about a third of you right now are saying, this product targets kids. Look, it's got a snowboarding cow. About a third of you are saying this product targets adults because it's organic. And about a third of you have completely disregarded my previous counsel from a few minutes ago and are saying the product, in fact, targets both parents and kids. I wish I could say you were all right in your own way. But no, in fact, Horizon Organic is targeting parents with this yogurt in a tube offering. If you were to look at the package, you would find the word organic printed 5 separate times just on the front of the box. Low fat appears twice. And there's also a notice informing customers that there were no antibiotics or pesticides or hormones used in production. This is a yogurt that a particular segment of parents would love for their kids to eat. So why the snowboarding cow? If this offering is targeting parents, why bother with the stuff that'll appeal to kids? Well, and this is an important point here, a part of the value that parents get from this yogurt is that their kids will eat it. In other words, targeting one group of customers, in this case parents, does not mean completely ignoring the preferences of the other groups involved in the acquisition and consumption of the offering. Some parents really want their kids to eat healthy, organic, pesticide-free foods. But if those foods taste like boiled kale, then their kids won't eat it. So the parents don't get what they want either. That's why the packaging has a snowboarding cow. That's why the yogurt comes in a fun tube. That's why the yogurt is sweet and simple and has fruit flavors. The easier it is to convince the kid to eat this healthy, organic, low-fat food, the happier the parent will be. So the target for Horizon Organics' offering is the parent, not the kid. Still not convinced? Well, let's look at some of the other kids' yogurts available in this grocery store's dairy case. Yoplait has a very similar offering. It's called Go-Gurt. The packaging of this yogurt is also brightly colored. and also features a cartoon character. But Go-Gurt usually features a cartoon character from a popular Nickelodeon or Disney Channel kids show. Dora the Explorer, Phineas and Ferb, SpongeBob, someone like that. To many adults, a cartoon character is a cartoon character. Snowboarding Cow, Dora the Explorer, what's the difference? To you, I say, Philistines. To most kids, there is, in fact, a huge difference. No kid has ever sprinted down the grocery aisle and clutched a package to their chest, begging their parents to buy something because it has a snowboarding cow on it. Only SpongeBob could inspire that kind of zeal. These yogurts minimize nutritional claims, relegating them to a single mention in the corner of the package. Instead, the packaging emphasizes the neon-bright colors and flavors not found in nature. The formulation seems mostly to consist of sugar. Why hasn't someone made an offering designed to appeal equally to both parents and kids? Because very rarely is decision-making in this category based on a lengthy debate between equals. Usually, it will either be the kids or the parents who drive the decision-making. And we see different types of yogurts to appeal to the primary decision-maker in each setting. A middle-of-the-road option would be outflanked by Go-Gurt when the kids are the ones choosing, and by Horizon Organic when the parents are the ones choosing. By trying to target both, you would probably miss both. So that's the first rule of targeting. Pick your target and accept that that means that everyone who is not your target customer is not your customer. You shouldn't be trying to please them. Now, let's turn to the second rule of targeting. Always pick a target segment that values what you have to offer. One of the common mistakes firms make is to go after a segment just because that segment is attractive to the company. Maybe this segment has a lot of disposable income, or maybe they are opinion leaders, and so can improve the brand's image if they start using the product. But the value that the customer would provide to the company is only half of the equation. You also have to consider whether you are capable of creating an offering that the customer actually wants. For example, did you know that in the early 1980s, Levi's produced a line of high-end men's suits? Of course you didn't know that. The suits flopped miserably. It's easy to see in retrospect why it might be a bad idea for a brand known primarily as a casual Western cowboy type of a brand might have a hard time jumping into the market where customers tended to value refinement and quality and status. So you might reasonably ask, why did Levi's choose to go into this market at all? Well, they failed to follow that second rule of targeting. They picked a segment that they valued. Levi's had conducted an extensive market research study in order to resegment the market and look for opportunities for growth. This by itself is not a bad idea at all. As I mentioned in the last lecture, segmenting or resegmenting a market is a great way to find new opportunities and to solve problems. When Levi's got the results of their market research back, they found there was one segment that was not particularly large, but accounted for a vastly disproportionate share of spending in the men's clothing market. Levi's called this segment the classic independents. These guys loved to buy high-end clothes. They had somewhat conservative tastes, but they knew what they liked and they were willing to spend to get it. And the classic independents loved buying three-piece suits. After discovering this segment, Levi's felt like they had struck gold. They saw dollar signs. They reasoned if they could capture just a small portion of what this segment was spending on clothes, it would drive real revenue growth for the company. So they dove right in. They developed a line of high-end suits, conservative cuts and colors, made from wool and wool blends. And by all accounts, the suits functioned just fine as suits. They looked nice. Quality was fine. But even if, objectively, the suits were decent, Levi's wasn't able to create an offering that the segment would value. For example, the classic independent went to specialty suit shops or independent tailors to buy his suits. Levi's didn't have access to those distribution channels, so they chose to sell through the same department stores they sold all their other goods through. This worked well for Levi's, but the classic independent would rather die than go and buy a suit at a department store like Sears. Levi's made a similar error in pricing. They priced the suit well above what was typical for Levi's products at the time. These suits were the most expensive items Levi's sold. They were also uncomfortably pricey for the department stores that were selling them. But the prices were comically low compared to what the classic independents were already paying for suits. Someone who's considering buying an Armani is not out to save a few bucks. Levi's was doing this guy no favors by offering him a discount. But the biggest problem was the Levi's brand. The classic independent might be happy to buy Levi's jeans for working in the yard, but he would be mortified if someone asked who made his suit and he had to open the coat and reveal the Levi's logo on the tag. So it's not enough for a segment to be attractive to you. That's necessary, but not sufficient. Your target must find your offering attractive too. In other words, you must be in a position to sell an offering that will create value for the segment you target. Both parties must come away from the transaction better off, or the whole thing is going to fail. So far, we've reviewed the two basic principles of good targeting. First, you should have a single target for each offering. And second, you should select targets because you can create value for them. With those two principles in mind, let's shift gears now and talk about how to pick a target. We'll be using a tool called the Attribute by Segment Matrix. This matrix is the next tool to go into our marketing toolbox. In order to create an attribute by segment matrix, you must have three types of information. First, you must have information about the possible segments that one could target. In other words, you must have already done your segmentation analysis. Second, you will need the attributes that are important in that product category. Finally, you will need an evaluation of how your offering and the offerings of all your competitors perform on those attributes. That's a lot of information. Let me illustrate the matrix with an example. In the early 2000s, all of the major video game systems were preparing to introduce new, updated versions of their consoles. The market leaders at the time were Sony PlayStation and Microsoft Xbox. Nintendo, which had ruled this market for much of the 80s and 90s, had seen a steady drop in market share. Nintendo was also looking to introduce a new platform, but if they had any hope of surviving, this had to be a major reboot. They really needed to get things right, so let's figure out what they did by using this attribute by segment matrix. The first thing you do, take a piece of paper, and along the left side, create the rows for the attributes that might be important for a gaming console. Ideally, you would do this by conducting market research, surveying the competitive positioning of your competitors, but if you don't have the time or money for that, you can usually gain at least some insights by trying to work it out for yourself. In order to make things easiest, when using an attribute by segment matrix, it helps if you frame each attribute in a positive way. I'll show you what I mean by that. For video games, graphics are going to matter to gamers. But instead of just writing the attribute graphics quality, instead write it as a positive attribute, right? Cutting edge graphics, something like that. That'll make it easier to interpret later on. So, we've got one attribute. Let's come up with some others. Let's think of ways game systems differ from each other. Some of the properties of the game system will depend on the types of games they support. Games can be, for example, highly involved. They can have complex storylines. They can demand a high skill level. They can be realistic. Game systems can also vary on the intuitiveness of their interface, their ease of use. We can include as many attributes here as we need to describe the market accurately and thoroughly. Okay, this is enough of an attribute list for us to work with. Now that we have listed our attributes in rows on the left, we'll want to make columns for each of our customer segments. If you remember from our last lecture, you know segments can be very specific and very detailed. For the purpose of this exercise, I'm going to keep it simple. We're only going to look at two very broad segments: gamers and non-gamers. Gamers we'll define as people who've been playing games for years or decades. Non-gamers are new to the category, with much less experience at buying and playing video games. So how would each of these segments rate the importance of all those attributes we just listed? Once again, ideally, you would fill in this part of the matrix by conducting some additional market research, actually going out and asking people in each segment how important each of these attributes are to them. But for now, let's go down the list of attributes and rate the importance of each one with just a score of high or low. How important are cutting-edge graphics to hardcore gamers? I would assume that attribute would be very important, so we'll rate that as a high in our matrix. What about highly involved games? Probably also highly important. In fact, if we go down the list, I think all of the attributes we listed are probably important to the gamer segment, until we get to the last attribute, easy-to-use game interface. For experienced gamers, a complicated interface is not a problem. In fact, it's almost a point of pride among gamers that they've figured out what all of the 400 buttons on an Xbox or PlayStation control paddle can do. So for this segment, having an intuitive interface is of low importance. Now what about the non-gamers? How do their preferences differ relative to the gamer segment? Well, although everyone loves nice graphics, in relative terms, non-gamers are probably less demanding on this front. So we'll rate graphics as medium importance. If you're relatively new to gaming, do you want to play something that's highly involved, that involves a lot of skill, that is very complex? Probably not. Those attributes would actually be seen as disadvantages. You probably want something that you try for the first time and immediately start having fun with, not something that you would slowly get better at after hours and hours of practice. So we'll rate all of those attributes as being low in importance. What about the intuitiveness of the interface? Now we get to an attribute that is very important to the non-gamer. This is the type of customer who will find the paddle with 30 buttons and triggers intimidating. The easier it is to use, the better. So that attribute we'll rate as being high in importance. Looking down our list, we see that gamers and non-gamers have completely different preference profiles. What's important to gamers tends to be less important to non-gamers and vice versa. That's not always the way it'll turn out. Depending on how you construct your matrix, there may be certain attributes that are important to all segments and others that are important to none. What you should not find at the end of this process is that two or more segments value exactly the same thing across the board. Remember, we created these segments based on differences in what they value. If two segments value exactly the same things, they're probably the same segment and should be collapsed into one. Okay, now we've got our attributes mapped into consumer values. It's time to look at our performance and the relative performance of our competitors. We'll start by making additional columns for our offering and also for the offerings of our competitors. So let's start with the Xbox. How did the Xbox perform in relative terms on graphics? Very well. This was a cutting-edge machine with very high-end video processing chips. The graphics were great. We'll give them a high on that attribute. What about highly involved games, complex games, games that involve high skill levels, and so on? Probably high on all of those attributes. As we mentioned, Xbox would score low on the intuitiveness of the controller. Try giving an Xbox controller to your grandmother. See how she reacts to that thing. Yeah, that's what I mean. In our PlayStation 3 column, we will have a similar performance on all the attributes listed. Now, in reality, Sony and Microsoft do not produce identical products, but in the simplified analysis we've done here, they have similar performance levels on all of these attributes. Now, we come to Nintendo. Nintendo looked at this competitive space in the early 2000s and realized they would have a hard time trying to fight against PlayStation and Xbox if they went right after the gamer segment. Gamers already had two very strong options to choose from, and those options seemed to match their preferences exactly. So instead of going toe-to-toe with Microsoft and Sony, Nintendo chose a different target entirely. They chose to create an offering targeted at non-gamers. And thus was born the Nintendo Wii. As a gaming system, the Wii was well behind the other consoles on the attributes that mattered most to gamers. Cutting-edge graphics and highly realistic gameplay? Are you kidding? The characters in the original Wii games had flesh-colored spheres for hands. Their faces were flat and expressionless. Their appendages weren't even connected to their bodies. The graphics were not there to impress anyone. Instead of engaging in an arms race with Sony and Microsoft to develop ever more detailed and more realistic games, Nintendo poured their effort into creating a simple and intuitive way of interacting with the game system. The result was the Wii Remote, a wand-like controller that uses motion sensors to interact with the game. So if players want to swing a tennis racket on the screen, they simply swing the remote as if it were the handle of the racket, and the game reacts accordingly. Returning to our attribute by segment matrix, whereas the Wii would score low on most of the attributes related to game complexity and visuals, they would score high on the one attribute that was most important to the non-gamers: ease of use. Non-gamers could pick up a Wii controller and within minutes, they were playing the game. It was fun. It was easy. Many hardcore gamers scoffed at the Wii when it first came out. As well they might. It didn't have any of the things they were looking for. But that's okay. Nintendo wasn't trying to create a game console that would appeal to that group. They had a different target, and they tried to serve that segment as best they could. And how did they do? Well, as of 2008, about 2 years after all three systems had launched, Xbox had sold 19 million units. PlayStation 3 had sold 13 million units worldwide. Impressive figures. But Nintendo's Wii had topped them both, with 24.5 million sales. They succeeded by following the rules of targeting. They didn't try to create some middle-of-the-road option, some product designed to appeal to everyone. Instead, they identified their target precisely and created a product to meet the specific needs of that target. If you can help your company think that way about marketing, you will vastly improve your chances of success.
This lecture is titled, Positioning Your Offering.